Conversations with foreign analysts strongly indicate a global perception of institutionalized fraud and dishonesty in the U.S. financial sector. In my view, it spans almost its entire spectrum. No, not all corporations engage in fraud, but every suite in the U.S. financial sector house contains prevalent fraud. This is utterly extreme, but not surprisingly, as a consequence to the green light given to deceit and swindle with the U.S. dollar no longer backed by gold. The end of a fiat currency game is replete with extremes. Gigantic bailouts are part and parcel of the extreme resolutions. The size of the mess, from housing and mortgage bond bubbles, is an order of magnitude larger than the lunatic long-term capital management mess in 1999. Expect a larger bailout, especially since it's denied vigorously. Worse this time, though, since confusion will abound. Questions remain unanswered. Did the U.S. Fed accept mortgage bonds offered only by Wall Street firms or only major banks? Major banks seem listed as big beneficiaries so far. Was the injection of 30-odd billion of funny money, otherwise called counterfeit funds in private sectors, a secret Wall Street bond bailout disguised poorly? Methinks yes. This seems extreme. The global economy seems like a rubber band stretched far past its specifications for usage. Labor arbitrage sends jobs to Asia. In return, they own vast tracts of U.S. dollar-based debt securities. The U.S. workers lose their jobs in droves. A giant step backward has taken place on product safety and quality. The end game seems to be trade sanctions, scuffles over currency manipulation, blame game, market ambushes, and lost sovereignty. Globalization sounds good, but in practice, it results in dislocation, conflict, and chaos. More extremes. Denials have been so broadly uttered by banking and economic and financial market leaders that your heads should spin. It becomes easier to make sense if you conclude that every denial is wrong, and the louder the denial, the more serious the effect. Now, Premier Bank in the Kansas City area is on the ropes, a Fed Reserve Bank. Like with a drunk, why ask if Uncle Jack is a drunk, if his behavior in life does not scream of alcoholism? Contagion of subprime mortgages to other debt securities is evident. Spillover to the real economy is evident, but not total, yet. Borrowing for consumption is impossible anymore. The housing recovery is a mirage. Housing sales and prices are nowhere near the bottom, as July existing home inventory shot up to 9.6 months' supply. The denials form an Orwellian backdrop where the system intends to deceive, to lie, and to misguide, so as to retain power and to keep the middle-class impoverishment process intact. What is missing is the recognition that past denials of important concepts have almost all been incorrect. No learning seems to result in Wall Street, just ongoing compromise and deception. The diabolic yet accepted merger of state and corporate interests is preached as something beneficial, a movement to keep America strong, to meet foreign competition and even aggression. Nonsense. The merger invites fraud and extreme profiteering, if not roll out the carpet to a totalitarian state. What extreme drivel. My experiment has resulted in one person out of 30 adequately citing what fascism is. The merger, called the Mussolini fascist business model, is the penultimate in inefficiency and the ultimate framework for colossal theft with near zero prosecution. The Goldman Sachs reduction from 9% to 2% in the gasoline weight of the GSCI commodity index serves as best understandable evidence of such fraud. Did Goldman Sachs short the gasoline futures before the decision to cut the weight by 7%? Of course, since if not, people would lose their jobs for a missed opportunity to profit. The permitted aristocratic fleecing inside financial markets is unspeakable and surely extreme. The latest denials have been reformulated into key questions. Is the U.S. economy heading into recession? Is the U.S. Federal Reserve grossly out of touch? The answers, in my opinion, are yes and yes. The U.S. economy is furiously addicted to easy credit, which has been curtailed. The home equity easy access wellspring has run dry. What an easy call recession is. Look for more extreme statistical distortion to prevent an official admission of recession. New infusions of liquidity will in all likelihood assist the friends of the powerful groups, not the rank and file, not the run-of-the-mill banks. Recent U.S. Fed injections went to the major banks almost without exception. The U.S. Federal Reserve is led by a university professor who has never run a business, never managed a financial account, never even worked in either, let alone worked in the private sector, but did serve as an apprentice on the Fed board itself. Such does not instill confidence or adequately prepare for the job of leading the U.S. Politburo of central planner lookalikes. Fortunately, his endless drivel about inflation expectations has ended. Reality will pull him at his leg, maybe the short arm. Then we have a mania of fear and political fixation on terrorism. In my estimation, the U.S. government, the U.S. military, and the shadowy groups who bear alphabet soup on unmarked lapels instill 1,000 times as much fear in my life as any Muslim lunatic in a faraway land. When a youngster with a relatively undeveloped brain, it was an easy call for me to conclude the Warren Commission was a whitewash in the wake of the J.F. Kennedy assassination. One can learn of unnatural deaths with some investigation, for all who stood on the Dallas grassy knoll. A similar whitewash is my conclusion for the 9/11 Commission in the wake of the World Trade Center attack. A scad of 30-year-old Treasury bonds issued before the 1971 departure from gold-backed U.S. dollars were stored in the World Trade Center vaults, and a scad of financial records pertaining to the J.P. Morgan and Enron case were stored in the third building. A scad of engineering professors have challenged the official reports, citing mere laws of physics. Are such engineers enemies of the state? The Nazis developed what was called Reich physics back in their day, so that science would salute the fascist regime. Other scientific disciplines followed suit. Even Robert Fisk casts much doubt on the truth beyond 9/11 events in the UK Independent editorial dated 25th August 2007. He is their Middle East correspondent. He outlines numerous questionable facts and seeming contradictions. My view is simpler. A syndicate took control of the White House since 1982, marred by a certain event, which pursues a secret agenda and a clandestine business. Enough. When habeas corpus is suspended, when internment camps are completed on U.S. soil, when torture is debated as justified, when preemptive attack is debated as justified, when confiscation of personal assets can be ordered in response to obstruction of a war whose cause was mostly faked, when unchecked executive decrees flow like a river, my fears are mainly directed within the 50 states and their federal commandants. This is an extreme situation leading potentially to a veiled military dictatorship. All precedent points to the fascist business model leading in parallel to a fascist government regime. A lot of effort is going into this unpublicized plan, probably not an idle exercise. It seems extreme. The degree of public trust in U.S. institutions is at rock bottom. The level of foreign distrust has never been greater, which likely will result in continued vengeance taken against both the U.S. dollar and its traded vehicle, the U.S. Treasury bond. That retribution could turn extreme. Over 70% of Americans do not trust their own Congress. the representatives who sit in their stead. They seem grotesquely compromised, bought, and paid. The 2006 midterm election mandate by the people has been ignored. The War Commission report and its recommendations have been ignored. Over 70% of Americans do not trust their own military to accurately and honestly report the status of the Iraqi war. Probably a higher proportion of Americans regard Wall Street as liars, parasites, con men, and fraud artists. The entire nation appears at an extreme crossroads. And that from an article published August 30th, 2007 by Jim Willey, Failed System and Failed State. Jim Willey is the editor of the Hat Trick Letter and the Golden Jackass website at goldenjackass.com. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren.
Farewell to all our Scottish fame. Farewell our ancient glory. Now Sark runs over the Solway sands, and Tweed runs to the ocean to mark where England's province stands. Such a parcel of a nation. What force or guile could not subdue through many warlike ages is wrought now by a with such a parcel of a rose in an nation.
That's A Parcel of Rogues, written by Robert Burns in 1791, performed by The Rovers Return. Key line design is a set of principles, techniques, and systems which form the logical basis for a plan for the sustainable development of rural and urban landscapes. The application of key line design presents a departure from mere soil conservation as practiced by so many. The application of key line pattern plowing, for example, is designed not to be satisfied with soil conservation, but with soil creation. One of the primary objectives of key line planning is to enhance the swift development of deep, biologically fertile soil, living soil. This is achieved through systematically designed farmscapes. Developing and deepening the soil's biological fertility will rebuild soil structure, reduce runoff, and increase the field capacity of the land. The land will more readily distribute, absorb, and hold water. That's how Australian key line designer Darren Doherty describes his discipline, which is a subset of the larger discipline of permaculture, all developed in Australia, where desertification and drought have long been a problem. Permaculture is a comprehensive systemic approach to the relationship of people to the land that combines modern understandings of how ecosystems work with traditional knowledge of sustainable land stewardship. This summer, I attended a course by Doherty given at the Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute near Ithaca, and next I'm going to play you an excerpt from that six-day course in order to give you a feeling for the broad significance of Doherty's work. I know that many of you are or would like to be farmers, and given the imperatives of peak oil combined with economic dislocation, many more will want to and need to take an active role in the future in producing food and restoring ecological balance. Darren Doherty will be back in the Finger Lakes from September 14th through 16th to give a free presentation as well as a two-day course in key line design. I'll provide the details at the end of the program for those interested in taking part. Please excuse the sound quality. This was recorded in a workshop situation. Here's Darren Doherty. He begins by explaining what prompted him to come to the United States.
A couple of quick things as to why we're here. As I said before, it's a numbers game for me, this whole key line business, and why I've decided to come to the US. When I read Alan Yeoman's book, called Priority One, interesting book, interesting on a lot of levels. It's the latest in a line of books on key line by the Yeoman's family. All of them have had a crack at it. P.A., the father, Dr. Neville Yeomans, who is the eldest son of the Yeomans family. He was a doctor of psychology, and he wrote about key line principles in psychology, which is a fairly interesting way to put it together. But he's got a very, very good article on the internet. If you do a search on Neville Yeomans and key line, there's a very interesting article that he's written. And he gives a lot of early history as a young fella with his father and Alan, the second son, when they were developing the key line concept. Key line wasn't just developed by P.A. Yeomans, it was he and his two eldest sons sitting around the kitchen table at their farm developing this whole thing. But certainly P.A. was a real driving force. The younger son, Ken, who was born in 1946, I think, he's like 14 years younger than Alan, who's the middle son. So quite a big difference in age. He put together another book, which is just behind us there. We'll talk a bit more about it later. Water for Every Farm, the Yeoman's Key Line Plan, which was released in 1994. And that was the last book written on key line. This one here, is a book about Keyline, but it's also a book about global warming. Using Keyline as a means to addressing global warming. Plus, it's a interesting and controversial book because of what it recommends. And this has been a bit antagonistic to many in the permaculture movement because it has some very interesting and controversial views on how we use energy in the future, particularly relating to the use of tropical areas and the removal of some tropical forest areas to grow biofuels for the future, to basically suggest that we can continue our exponential growth path on a biofuel economy. There's some pretty interesting figures in there. And also Alan is suggesting that we need to remove ourselves from fossil carbon and that we need to move wholly for industrial power to nuclear power. So Alan's a very smart guy. He's got a postgraduate degree in nuclear physics, which he got as a 70-year-old. So he knows his stuff. He's also an engineer, a builder, mechanical engineer, a builder, and quite a few other things. And as he says, you know, when you ask him, you know, what his biggest claim to fame is, and he says, well, it's inventing the banana lounge. Does anyone know? You've probably all sat on a banana lounge. He invented them in the late 50s, I think. You know those aluminium frame chairs that go click, 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 that you lie on the beach on, or haven't they've got a little fold-out legs and whatnot? Yeah, he invented that. as well as developing the Yeoman's Keyline plough, which...
Second,
with his father in the 60s and 70s. So now we've got this book. Now, from the perspective of numbers, Alan clearly painted some pictures, which really told it to me. One was that the Earth's atmosphere is, if we were to condense it, 11.9 metres thick. So if we were to condense that 50-odd kilometres of atmosphere that we have above the lithosphere, and turn it into water, then it would be 11.9, or about 39 feet thick. Okay?
So you condensed it to water.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's interesting enough. That's not very much. Not very much at all, right? And then he said, all right, well, if we were to look at our pre-1750 carbon dioxide levels were about 270 parts per million. And right now... I think we're up, right now we're at about 380, and it's climbing at a rate that's quicker than has been predicted. Now, if we were to take this carbon, because carbon dioxide is 27% carbon, elemental carbon, if we're to actually take that carbon down to soot, right, carbon dust, then it would basically, there's no point in me doing it, but it would basically be a layer in this 39 feet that would be about as thick as my fingernail. And the layer that's causing us the problem is about as thick as this piece of paper on top of that fingernail. So what we've got to do, that 100-odd parts per million, we've got to actually take that away, so that we can get back to some sort of climate stability, which is pretty well what we think is around about 270. Now, that's interesting. When you look at it from that perspective, it sort of brings it down to a scale that humans can sort of deal with, the mere creatures that we are. And so Alan then said, all right, well, if that's the case, then let's look at the Earth's lithosphere, the terrestrial surface, And 11%, thereabouts, of that area is arable. Arable agriculture. Now, what Alan worked out from that is that to get us to go from here to here means that we need to increase organic matter by the mere figure of 1.6% on 11% of the Earth's terrestrial surface, the lithosphere.
1.6%
increase in organic matter, humus. Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah, let's go. Exactly, yeah. So I saw those figures and I went, I had the same reaction. I thought, yeah, this seems doable. But there's a real difficulty in that. That's still a lot of area. And what we've got, so we can only impact 0.005% of that. Which might be, I don't know, I'm just pulling figures here, that might be the organic agriculture that's out there. Now, since coming to the United States, I'll just divert a little bit, I've found that organic agriculture doesn't quite have the same meaning in the US, according to what I've seen, as it does in Australia at least. Australia has the largest area of certified organic acreage in the world. Mainly as a virtue of certified organic and biodynamic pastoral operations, as opposed to cropping operations. I would suggest that, say, the US would probably have the largest cropped area. So areas that are actually in arable agriculture as opposed to pastoral systems. In Australia, there's a lot of things that are allowed that are not allowed in Australia but are allowed here under the USDA organic regulations. Some of the standards that we are working towards is things where we're looking at environmental management systems monitoring of farms as whole units, as whole ecological units. So instead of just looking at it as primarily organics as being an industrial version of an organic version of industrial agriculture, which is what it basically appears to be here, actually moving it in Australia, it's being moved so that you have to actually prove that you are moving beyond sustainability. That you're not sustainable is not enough. That you actually have to be in some sort of regenerative practice. Okay?
Are there standards for water management?
The whole thing. Wow. So we're moving into, it's called EMS 9001. So it's just like if you get your business certified, as I you're all familiar with the corporate structures that go under this same sort of model, where your whole business goes through some sort of certification, ISO. Or whatever, there's different standards across the planet, but they all basically have to go through this whole process of audit, and then your system is then classified accordingly. That's what both conventional agriculture is starting to do now in Australia, and definitely organic agriculture is starting to do in Australia. So when we're moving beyond the idea of just mere sustainability, that also fits with P.A. Yeoman's antagonism with the soil conservation movement of the 1950s, 60s, 70s and in the early 80s. The whole word conservation to Yeoman's was totally antagonistic. It was like a red rag to a bull, as we would say. Now Yeoman's said, why do we need to stop at mere conservation? We actually have to move to creation. Okay? And now that comes through to where we are today with a lot of our permaculture thinking, because which has come from the likes of Yeoman's thinking, which is where we need to look beyond just merely sustaining something. We actually need to be into a practice of regeneration. So we're moving from just keeping the inputs and the outputs fairly equal to actually getting more outputs for lesser inputs. So that's, and then have to deal with that horrible thing called yield management. abundance management, which is something that's that a lot of people in permaculture find themselves having to deal with on a daily basis. It becomes quite difficult to deal with yield because you can, by use of this thing up here, what's between your ears, you can radically increase yield. That's basically what limits yield is imagination, which is a principle of permaculture. So when I saw those numbers, and because I've known for years having a keyline plow, and I've read all of my soil tests, and I've seen that, you know, after one pass of a keyline plow with some of the pastoral management that we've been able to do, I saw that we were able to increase organic matter by 5 or 6% in one season. So I thought, well, I can do that, and I can do that for about $30 an acre. I thought, well, that seems quite reasonable, and do it, not necessarily on this, but do it on pastoral land, okay? So pastoral land, land that basically is, if we were to do a land classification on it, do you have here with your whole farm planning practices things called land classes?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you do a one. It's usually a class 1 to 8 classification. Class 1 land basically is fully arable, has basically no impediments to arable tillage-based agriculture. The soil drains well. It doesn't have a slope that's problematic. The soils are usually self-mulching clays, clay loams, with a high nutrient exchange capacity and water holding capacity. Yeah, as good as you'll get, you know. Some of the soils that you'll find in the Midwest, right, that they're doing...
South Dakota.
There. Let's go there. Yeah. Idaho, all of those sorts of places. Iowa, etc. Hudson River Valley. We've got a few spots in Australia, but little eeny-weeny bits where potato growers grow their potatoes. 300-metre deep soils, you know, that sort of thing. Which you'll have here. You'll have a few of those. So you've got that, and then you go all the way down to Class 8. Now, Class 8 is land that basically cannot withstand any agriculture because it's rocky, it's got a high slope angle, cannot even withstand any occasional grazing. So what we're looking at is sort of in this, or what a lot of my work has been focusing on is in Australia, is working in this sort of pastoral zone. Now, the pastoral zone is outside of this 11%. There's actually a lot more of that than there is of the stuff that we can annually till with any degree of safety. And that zone there is also the area, importantly, from a keyline perspective, where we can graze as well. It's a pasture zone. And the pastoral zone, using pasture is the quickest way and the cheapest way of increasing soil organic matter. And as we increase soil organic matter, by default, we're reducing CO2 levels in the atmosphere just through basic photosynthesis. So it's a very, very, very pervasive means of being able to address it. And at the same time, we're able to actually use agriculture as the means to address this issue. Because we have a lot of pastoral lands here. But it has to be organic. Because we can't build organic matter quickly unless we follow organic methods. You can't continue to go out and use your fertility out of a bag and try and increase organic matter. It has to happen using natural means. So that's a, which we'll talk about through this whole process. Now, that's what Alan's pointed out in here in a couple of chapters. The rest of it, is very, very informative on the basis of talking about. Well, look, there's even a section on how nuclear bombs work. The history of ecological theories, promoting the idea of trees as a carbon sink, but not its timber products. There's just a lot of stuff in here talking about all of the different energy sources that are being put out there at the moment. Alan also talks about how, according to his belief, the Green Movement and a lot of the people in the Green Movement have been used as pawns by the carbon industries, the fossil carbon industries, and which is a fairly interesting thought. And I know for a fact in Australia that that's quite clear. With our a few of our I won't mention any names because we're on. But quite a few crowds in Australia have been very, very active and disproportionately so active against any nuclear power generation in Australia, whilst not saying one thing about coal. Not one thing. And have not said one thing about the nuclear radiation that comes from coal itself, which is something does anyone know about that here?
No.
Yeah. All right. Who's got a water filter at home? A carbon-based water filter? Probably. Yeah. Now, carbon is an interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff. Ethan will know this because who's done Jeff Lawton's courses here? Jeff's all over this stuff. Carbon attracts everything. Everything sticks to carbon, which is part of its promise, but also part of its problem as well, particularly when we burn the stuff. Right. But part of its promise is that when we build up carbon in soils, all of the heavy metals and all of that sort of stuff become bound to it. And if our pH is at the right level, then that renders a lot of those inert. Okay, so they're not water soluble anymore. So that's from a biological remediation perspective, that's fantastic. We've got some fantastic things on this planet that we take a lot for granted and don't understand at the same time. Now, during the Jurassic Carboniferous period, you know, about 250 to 150 million years ago, we had a period of greenhouse. So what we're sort of proposed to go into now. Increased, I think it was around 400, 500 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And plants were just going gangbusters, growing a lot of stuff. You know, the dinosaurs were about and all that sort of business. Now, when all of that material fell down or was burnt or whatever, that laid down all of the carbon deposits that we have across the planet. Which I think are in the order of 3,000 billion tons of coal deposits on the planet. We've got about 300 years left, apparently, of
That's 3 trillion.
Yeah. And oil, on the other hand, there's about 300 million tons of oil in the ground, of which we're apparently at the peak of now. So if we were to look at the digress, if we were to look at, so here's sort of 1750 again, that magic time when industry started apparently. And here we come to about 1990, thereabouts. We've had this exponential growth path of using fossil energy, oil energy in particular. And now we're apparently at the point where, which is called the Hubbard Peak, where we'll no longer be, we're not going to produce any more oil than we produce right now. So you could say the glass is half empty or half full. But at the same time, that's our consumption line. Our consumption line is going up. Right, so if you have consumption going up or demand going up and supply going down potentially, then we've got a bit of a problem in between here now. So that's for oil. But for coal, oil's, I don't believe, is our problem. It's actually coal that's a problem. Because coal is cheap and it's easy to extract, and there's massive amounts of it still left. Like 10 times the amount of coal than there is oil. We've got one mine in Australia that's 75 kilometres long. And I mean, it's terrible. I just saw a video about what's happening in Virginia. I saw a video the other day. They're just taking whole mountains away. It's sort of like the Mount St. Helens eruption, just taking that whole top of the mountain away and taking the coal and then moving on to the next mountain. It's quite disgraceful, but that's what goes on. So coal, we've still got a lot up left. So the coal peak is 300 years into the future before we actually get to the coal peak, right? So that's what's fueling. They're building like 5 or 10 coal stations, coal-powered power stations in China every week, apparently, or some ridiculous number, according to your vice president. What was I going to say? Now, carbon as a filter. That stuff's been in the ground for a couple of hundred million years. Now, water is a universal solvent. All of these things, we've got radiation coming in from this thing up in this big nuclear furnace in the sky coming in all of the time. We've got all sorts of stuff buzzing in. Some of it's being deflected back out into space. Some from clouds and from ice caps and all of the rest of it. Some of it's is absorbed by different atmospheric elements. Some of it is actually absorbed. All of these different types of radiation. Now, water is a universal solvent. It grabs onto pretty well everything. That water percolates down through the strata and carries with it all of the all of these radioactives. Okay? And guess what? Our planet's also one big nuclear reactor. So we've got stuff coming from both ways. So where we've got these coal seams all over the place, these are actively filtering and capturing radioactives.
Plus a whole bunch of other stuff.
Plus a whole bunch of other stuff. Heavy metals, you name it. The whole lot is all going into here. Now, where it is in the Earth is really advantageous for us when it's kept there, because it actually acts as a sink for all of that stuff. Yeah. Right? And this is where feedback becomes interesting. A lot of our feedback... Does everyone understand the idea of feedback? So I can put water into that glass and I'll keep pouring it in. And at one point, it's just going to sit there and have what's called a meniscus. It's going to be the maximum before that cup becomes full or over full. I put one more drop and then all of that meniscus is released. And that's what I mean by feedback. We don't know at what point some of the feedback from, say, increasing from 380 to, say, 420 might be. 420 might be some sort of tipping point where we get a rapid amount of melting of the ice caps, like even more rapid than what is happening now. Then what does that do? And all of these sorts of things then start to go into a bit of systems haywire, okay? Just the same as my simple feedback here is I pour in too much, one drop too much, and then I've got a mess on the table to clean up. That's what you would call a storm in a teacup, I suppose. Yeah. Well, it's the same with this stuff. If we keep taking this stuff out, we're burning it, so it's becoming atmospheric. As we burn carbon, it combines with oxygen and becomes carbon dioxide, and then it becomes atmospheric, it becomes gaseous, right? So that's one thing. What we're also doing is we're removing this balance that I don't think we're even close to get an understanding of how big a role in actually holding on to radioactives this carbon layer has. Right, so we're putting that stuff back out, because when we burn this coal, we're releasing an enormous amount of radioactives. And one of the prime products that come out of coal-powered stations is fly ash, which is distributed amongst the population now as a prime cement additive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. How about that, hey? Yeah. Now, Alan believes that some background radiation is actually not that bad. I'll leave that one to you guys to go through, because I'm certainly very novice at all of this sort of understanding of nuclear stuff, or stuff nuclear. We know that there's plenty of research that suggests that a small amount of radioactivity is actually not harmful to humans. It actually keeps us going, keeps us vital. If we were to live in a test tube in a totally isolated environment from all of this sort of thing, we would be very sick human beings indeed, because the constant feedback that humans have in their interaction with the environment is actually what keeps us alive and able to increase our health. So having the occasional sickness, having the occasional bit of bombardment is actually a reasonable thing for us.
Who's doing this work, or who's like writing and talking about, you know, this idea of the sort of the carbon, the coal as a barrier keeping radiation within the air? Where's that coming from? Never heard that.
Never heard that? Well, I've never heard all of this either, but it seems makes absolute sense to me. If we were to look at the planet, well, we've got, the planet is not encased in a layer of carbon, right? It's only got seams of coal throughout the planet, so there's only so much of it here and there. But Yeomans talks about it. He's definitely talking a lot about this stuff that's coming in from the outside. But it makes absolute sense that it's coming from both directions. The point being is that when we burn this stuff, when we bring it out of the ground, we're now releasing it. Right, where it's quite stable, it's under maybe hundreds of metres of earth, it's locked down there. It's basically how we would dispose of radioactives in the first place, from nuclear power plants. When we burn it, we concentrate it. When we have it in plants, we concentrate it. That stuff gets then ferried out as radioactives, and a lot of radioactive waste comes out of coal-powered power stations, electricity stations. So, seems pretty crazy that there's been such a focus from environmental groups on the nuclear fallout or radioactives build-up from nuclear power plants, but no mention at all from what comes from coal. And that's because a lot of these groups are funded by big oil and big coal. It's a very, very pervasive force. A lot of our groups in Australia are funded by oil companies and by coal companies. I'm not going to name names, but it's the who's who.
I'd say in this country it's perhaps a little different, because there's pretty strong activism around coal, particularly in the Appalachian regions.
There is now too in Australia.
And there has been actually some very, just this spring there was a very significant decision that curtailed some of the mining practices in terms of mountaintop removal. But
in terms of all of this sort of stuff, in terms of looking at nuclear as an option, which I personally don't agree with, because I personally have a problem with our exponential growth culture. I think that's just a nonsense. So Alan and I will stand to disagree on that. That's our right to do so. I don't think that we can continue on the path that we're going on. That the status quo can continue. Yeah, it just doesn't add up to me.
I'm going to ask that 0.005%.
That wasn't clear to me what that. Well, what I'm saying is that, say, that's the only area that we can actually impact. there might actually be a few extra zeros on there, as per what you were saying. you know, the area that we, in the next 10 years, with all of our activism, with all of our work in the field in trying to increase the amount of organic matter in soils across this country and across the planet, will not even get close to that. It might, if we can get to 1%, we're doing really, really well. Really well. If we could increase by 1%, 1.6% the organic matter on 1% of the arable area of this planet, then you would get a Nobel Prize for doing that, I reckon.
You know what those areas are like as far as acres?
You could calculate that. I think that they're in the book, but the point is that it's a pretty small area, and it appears small from a numbers perspective. But even that sort of area there is a 0.005% of the lithosphere of this planet is a very, very large area. That's a very large area, and that's the sort of discussion that I'd like people to start to have in part of the communication. But don't talk for too long, because we don't know at what sort of point that feedback loop, that tipping point, is going to be. We just don't know when that's going to be. So now what we also can pretty well guarantee is that's the figure based on the difference between here and here. What we can definitely realise is that this, in terms of coal consumption and therefore coal emissions, most of the coal-powered electricity generation plants in China and India are running at about 15 to 20% efficiency. So that's like super bad, right? They're starting to talk to Australia about clean coal, because Australia's got a problem with coal as well. We're behind Luxembourg as the world's highest carbon dioxide emitters. We produce 20 Luxembourg, which is like got about 10 people. We have 20 million people, and we produce on average per person 27, 28 tons, metric tons, of carbon dioxide emissions per person per year. You guys produce about 22, 23. So we're a good 5 or 6 ton higher than you guys. That's a lot of material.
Except there's a lot more of us.
There's a lot more of you, yeah. That's why you produce about 30% of the global emissions as a result.
There's no nuclear reactors in Australia?
We have one reactor in Sydney that's used. It's with the CSIRO, the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation. And that's just a research reactor. But no, we don't have nuclear power. But we have 60% of the world's uranium resources. We are the world's mine. We also are the world's largest coal exporter. So if you want it, we've got it.
We don't need it, we've got it.
Yeah, you've got it. But we export it to India and China and Japan. Japan is our largest market. We've supplied 45% of Japan's coal needs comes from Australia. And I think 20% of China's needs, which sort of says something. I've got plenty of those figures. Our domestic output in Australia in terms of carbon dioxide is 750 million tonnes per year. The result from the coal that we sell, and from the coal that we sell, not the oil or the natural gas that we also are rich in, is 770 million tonnes per year.
In addition to the first 750 million.
Yeah. So when we say that we are net, that we produce 27, we actually produce about 54. Plus... So it starts to become a bit scary. But that's what I mean about here. We've got to look at... People talk a lot about peak oil, and people talking about peak water and peak this, peak permaculture. all these sorts of things. There's no key line peak yet. When that happens, we'll be in paradise. If we get to here, that means that we have consumed a lot of coal, and we will. I don't know what the figures will be, but this figure here is going to be much, much higher than this, I reckon. Which means that we need to increase this figure on probably less land. Okay, so all of the figures. This is why, to me, it's a numbers game. It's about time. And it's about organic matter, and it's about area. That's basically what the whole thing's about. So
we're not going to get to that peak, though. There's no way. Just the situational.
Well, we don't
get to the peak of coal use.
That's yeah, I know, because it's time in a bottle. All of this stuff.
Yeah.
It's so that's a pretty interesting phenomena that we're going to have to deal with. So now you can understand why I'm here. And why I'd like to get a lot more of these classes, even if they're just 2 hours, even if they're just having you guys talking to people and just saying, well, look, are you aware that this is a potential? How can you change your buying habits just as a mere consumer to start to do this? But then there's that juxtaposition where if you're buying organic produce in the United States, it's not necessarily a system of husbandry. It's not a. I mean, some of the systems I've seen here are disgraceful. And I'm being kind. I've seen some absolutely horrendous certified, grade A certified organic systems here. I think that they need to move into the EMS stuff, though. That you actually need to move beyond sustainability.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because otherwise, it's just maintaining status quo.
You've been listening to an excerpt of a 6-day workshop given by Australian key line designer and permaculturist Darren Doherty last summer at the Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute near Ithaca. And as I said before, Doherty will be back in the area from Friday, September 14th through September 16th. On Friday, September 14th, he's going to be giving a free pasture walk, which will occur from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the grazing farm of Oliver and Andrea Scott, Wideside Farms, in Bloomfield, New York. A simple buffalo meat lunch will be served at noon. Then, on Saturday and Sunday, from 9 to 5 p.m. each day, he will be giving a course in key line design principles at the Community College of the Finger Lakes Campus Lecture Hall in Canandaigua, New York. The 2-day course is targeted at farm land managers who have an interest in applying key line design techniques on their property. Topics will include the history of key line design, scales of permanence, design applications, low-tech cartography, surveying, site analysis techniques, broadacre soil improvement techniques, key line soil renovation and pattern cultivation, and key line water harvesting earthworks design and construction. There is a fee for that course. To find out more information, contact Royal Purdy at area code 315-986-7007. That's 315-986-7007, or email elysian@ahtuttle.com. elysian@ahtuttle.com. Darren also has a website, www.permaculture.biz. permaculture.biz, that's B-I-Z. And even if you're unable to attend this particular thing but would like to learn more about permaculture, the Finger Lakes Permaculture Institute has ongoing courses and demonstrations. You can reach them on the web at fingerlakespermaculture.org. Thank you for listening to another edition of Unwelcome Guests. This and all previous shows are available on the web in the archives at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Down, like an old-